So I'd like to start by asking you about the story behind your appointment to the cabinet and to Pemandu. You know, how did the Prime Minister bring you on board initially?
It's been a long story. I was working for Shell for quite a long time, 23 years, and spent time abroad, such as in the UK and the Netherlands and also Sri Lanka, and did quite a lot of work in Shell that had to do with turnaround and transformation. Until I got called, by that time the government asked me to come and become the CEO of Malaysia Airlines, and the company was, it has its biggest loss in its corporate history. I don't know whether you know the story.
Yes.
And we had, when I came in and I agreed to do the job as a CEO to turn it around, we had cash only lasting us for 3.5 months. If we didn't change it in 3.5 months, made the difference. There was no money for salary, there was no money for fuels. And so that work that I did there, we turned it around. In the first year we broke even, in the second year we made record profit. And so that was when the government began to notice what was happening there, because the government owns majority stake in Malaysia Airlines. They own about 69% of the equity there. It was from that work that I got to know the Deputy Prime Minister. When he came into cabinet, then he said, come and share some of your views on how we go around to do the transformation. So the government ran a couple of workshops from the time he became the Prime Minister, and that's in April 2009. So I was in 5 of the cabinet workshops. I was an outsider. I was invited to give input to them and how they might go about doing it. And throughout that period of time, and they were trying to persuade me to join as a cabinet minister. And that was conversation we had, and I looked at how serious they were. For me, it was a question of, until and unless I felt convinced that the cabinet, including the Prime Minister, were really serious about the transformation process, I wasn't interested to join. And when I talk about being serious, my definition of transformation, it must be 3 things: big, result, fast. And if it's not big and it's not quick and if it's not results oriented, I'm not interested. So because that orientation was such, you will never get big result fast unless you have tremendous commitment to do something, and it cannot be seen as a job, it must be seen as a calling. It's beyond just going out to do a job. And so if I came out to assist in doing that, and I need to know that the entire leadership in the government, the whole of the cabinet, was actually really interested in that kind of transformation. If they wanted to do continuous improvement or Kaizen, I wasn't interested. And that is a long drawn process, maybe 5 to 10 years to see results. I wasn't interested in that kind of transformation process. And the 5 cabinet workshops that we had from April right up to September, when I finally said yes, all of those workshops gave me clear confidence that the whole cabinet, the whole leadership was really serious about wanting to do what they had to do on those chosen areas: fighting crime, corruption, rural basic infrastructure, urban public transport, low-income household, and education. And so when you're serious, you can't be serious about everything. You need to be focused. And those were the areas that they chose to do it. And during this workshop, we began to talk about what are the kind of things that we were going to do to make a real change and real transformation in those chosen areas. And that was why I eventually said to the Prime Minister, okay, I will join you. And so I joined on the 1st of September.
I see. And can I now ask, now that you're at Pemandu as CEO, who do you perceive as your constituencies, sort of the groups or individuals who you have to get buy-in from before pursuing a course of action?
It's the citizens, absolutely clear. Everything that we're doing here for the people of Malaysia.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you say generally for the people of Malaysia, then you peel the onion and then you look at it, because there are specific constituents within the people of Malaysia. Take an example: rural basic infrastructure. So these are rural people. Those are the specific constituent for that particular NKRA. Urban public transport, it's the urban folks that we're handling. And even within that, it's the urban folks that rely on urban public transport, not the guys who drive cars. And so the constituents within that, it actually narrowed down to the very specific. When you get down to education, and even for preschool, it's the kids that are attending the preschools and the parents. So the targeting, that everything that we were doing was very specifically addressed to the recipients of that particular activity.
Yes, I think that's constituents in terms of the recipients of the activity. But I think my definition is more, who do you perceive as the groups you interact with most frequently to get, you know, policies enacted, things done? Who do you perceive as your constituencies on the high level, essentially?
I think when we started to do it, I mean, we get down to approvals. Government money obviously comes from government. And so if you want to spend money to do it, when you say government needs to approve certain amount of money for rural roads, the cabinet must bring it and must agree, and it needs to come to parliament. Mm-hmm. And if the parliament rejects the budget, you don't have the budget to do it now. For parliament to agree, opposition included, they need to know this is money well spent, worthwhile spending. So usually they return to what is the constituent saying. So that is why when we did the work, we had laboratories and we people inside the labs, and we had town hall sessions. So public acquiescence and agreements about what we do is critical, because when we had the town hall, we invited people from the public to come and look at what we were intending to do, the entire program, and we then got them to say how many of what percent of them supported this work, where were the changes that they wanted us to make, where were the refinements. By the time we put it together, that whole proposal was really what the public wants us to do as a responsible government. And so this was not something that we did in the smoke-filled room and then suddenly we came out to say we got the cabinet to agree and done and dusted. No, it was a whole thing, a whole program that was developed in the lab. We got public acquiescence through town hall sessions in Kuala Lumpur, in KK, and in Kuching, if you know the geography, and so a lot of people had. And so because of that, when we came down to getting parliamentary approval and cabinet approval, it was, to my mind, it's fait accompli, because that's the wishes of the rakyat, the public, was really endorsing it. So to my mind, you start getting the people wanting it to be done. I do believe that People say political will to do a certain thing. Political will is granted when there's political acquiescence. And that political acquiescence comes from the rakyat and the people wanting to say this is priority for us. And so the town hall session approach that we do here, I think it's the first time that we in the government actually done it quite like that. It's really, really detailed. So when we did in Kuala Lumpur, we had 2 days of it.
These are the open day sessions.
Open day session, and we put all the slides and plastered them on the wall. And we invited everybody to come, whoever was interested to come and engage with us. And we have very robust discussions on some of them, including, for example, on corruption, urban public transport. And it was such a great opportunity to engage directly with the men in the street, the women in the street. But they have tremendous ideas and how to improve the transport, the rail and the buses, etc. And it's a long story. I respond to answer your question, but I always return still to the public constituency.
Can I then ask, you know, in September when you came on board at Pemandu, what were the first steps you took, and how did you build a team initially?
Yeah, well, when I first came there, and I just went, and it was me and just me and my immediate assistant. That came in, and then we built a small team. But because we wanted to hit the ground running, the first thing we did was to run laboratories. And so within a month upon arrival, we started running 6 laboratories. That means 200 over people in labs. I can't remember, 261.
250.
250 thereabout. And so they were inside the lab. And because I didn't have my own staff yet hired, we then hired some consultants. I personally trained them on the techniques of labs. So I had to go and train all of them to facilitate. Many of the consultants have not done labs before.
And can you speak more about the lab methodology and how you adopted it and changed it from your previous experience?
Yeah. So what we did in the lab does a couple of things. One is the lab begin to put very high ambitions, very, very tall targets, almost what we call impossible targets, targets that will cause you to have fear of failure. And so stretch target is a key thing that you didn't do. For example, crime rates has been rising in Malaysia for the last 4 years before we were doing this. And when we set up a target to say the street crime in the first year must come down by 20%, everyone had said, this is impossible. And I tell you why that was a very important part of the lab. It's this. If we came with an incremental target that is reduce street crime by 1%, there is no need to transform. You can use your old ways of doing it and achieve that result. No transformation required. You just have to run a little harder. You'll get it. But if we were to say to them, in 1 year, bring street crime by 20% down, there is no way the old ways of doing it can achieve that. You require a radical approach and an outside-the-box thinking to solve this. So the starting point was to put such a tall target, and therefore the things that you do it has to be very different from the way in which you have done it before. And so, but the solutions inside there, the solutioning was, I always believe this, people actually know the solutions, but the reason why they don't execute it is because there are a lot of roadblocks along the way. So you have good ideas, the ideas were already there, people know about this thing for a long time. But to move it from idea to results, there are hurdles such as technical hurdles, political hurdles, there are administrative, there are process hurdles, there are system hurdles along the way. So what we were focusing inside the room was identify the solutions that were already existing, and we got a lot of ideas from other countries that done similar things, and we make adaptations to suit, but we're really focusing on how do we make sure that the hurdles that prevented us from doing this before is now removed in the labs.
And can I ask, what context had you used the lab methodology before, and how was it different this time around? How did you change the methodology for the public sector?
All right. So in the government, it's new for me, but I've done it in the private sector many times, and we did it in Shell, we did it in Malaysia Airlines. The key difference between the two is that when I did it in the corporate world, a lot of things hinged on the KPI that's related to making a lot of profit, the profit and loss statement, the P&L. So everything that we were doing, we measured it against the net income after tax and how do we improve the profitability and the growth. Now, of course, when you look at the government, you have to look for different sets of KPI. And so whatever the set of KPI that you put there, that's the thing that will determine what are the things that you do. And so essentially it's the same. Here is a KPI that's very much profit maximization, at the same time growth for the business. Here is about what is the KPI that is needed for us to know that we are successful bringing crime rates down. For example, education, making sure that we improve the student outcomes. We make sure that a lot more of them, the students, have access to preschool, etc., etc. So essentially the difference is just making sure you have the right measurement to constitute what is success. But that is a very important discussion, and I do believe that people take this very lightly, and people make KPIs without really seriously understanding what constitutes success. And I do believe if you have a large group of people that's involved, every one of them need to go to a process of debating and arguing until they are aligned on the right sets of KPI. The danger now is this. You can come with loads of KPI. And because everybody, it's a cop-out strategy, and everybody says, oh, my KPI is needed, and this KPI is needed. You end up with so many KPIs. And in the end, everyone is actually, there is no more way of saying, where's the trade-off? Because in life, you said, I maximize this I actually sacrifice. And so bringing it down to a very core set of things that you're actually going to measure is critical, because that is useful for decision-making process on trade-offs.
And related to that, can I ask, what is your role as CEO of Pamandu in the ministerial KPI initiative? If you don't mind elaborating on that.
Yeah, I am the architect of the transformation, and that's very simple. If you want to build a house, you'll always find the architect is the guy that thinks about how is this house going to be built. The same architect may employ a certain engineer, a certain group of builders and workers, and these people may be working for a different architect, but they'll produce a different house. And the person that comes with the thinking process behind how we're going to do it, the whole program, setting up the program, what's the KPI, what's the activities, how do you monitor it, what systems are put in place, and what the reward system, how do you communicate this? The whole architecture behind it is critical. So the first thing I did was, when we came out to do it, is that this process, the architecture behind it, lab, town hall, book, engagement, and report. Mm-hmm. And so we've said that's what we need to do. People say, why do you need to do that? The lab is so that we develop the idea quickly, and the mass solutions must be done in 6 weeks. It's not 6 months, 6 weeks. Mm-hmm. It's a methodology. Town hall, getting public feedback and input, tremendous. Writing the book so that we tell everyone, this is what we are going to do, and we are committed to implementing it. And when you put it out so detailed to the public, you have no choice. Mm-hmm. You have to deliver it. Because once you're pregnant with this, you have only one consequence, you have to deliver. Mm-hmm. And so this whole architecture behind it, for example, if we didn't take the approach of publishing the book in such detail in the program form, there's a lot of opportunity to run mm-hmm. and hide. By publishing and declaring it like that, you have no choice. Mm-hmm. It's like a salesman's nightmare. You're committed to deliver. You now have to produce a product and deliver. Mm-hmm. And so we've also committed to say that at the end of each year, when you finish the year, we will write a report declaring to the public what we have delivered and also not delivered. Mm-hmm. And so this whole architecture drives in commitment, accountability, transparency. Mm-hmm. And so I tell you, when you go and follow this form, this architecture on the chains, the biggest thing that comes in the way for top leadership is how to conquer that fear of failure. Mm-hmm. Nobody wants to come out and print a document precisely about what you intend to do. Most people will say, Idris, can we put up a document that is glossy, that is full of words, mm-hmm. but they don't have very specific targets that mm-hmm. are set out there. So most people would like to have that kind of a document that, you know, you can have tremendous opportunity to run. So my role in the cabinet is really playing the transformation architecture role mm-hmm. and to cause it to happen.
And can I ask, you know, as a relative newcomer yeah. to the public sector, where do you feel what are the areas in which you feel you face the steepest learning curve?
Well, the first one that I had encountered when I joined was, which part of the public are you listening to? And this is a real challenge. When you listen to the public, I kind of feel that the loudest may not necessarily form the majority. And so you'd have to really, really make sure that you listen mm-hmm. to the crowd, because generally speaking, you find that the majority is silent, the silent majority. And so you find some very noisy group, they may not actually represent the majority. So some of these, it's a real challenge to get that through. Mm-hmm. And so that is tough to do. Whereas in the private sector, that didn't come out quite like that. You know, you make money if you turn out and make a profit. That means the customers love your product and your service. That's why they came to you anyway. So that's easy to do. But I find it's very difficult when you put public policies, things that you're changing out there, and public opinion is not clear way of checking mm-hmm. it out. And so that's single largest thing that I found very difficult. And I do find also another more difficult thing that we're doing here is that I've never worked in a company where the workforce, equivalent workforce, is 1 million. Mm-hmm. So the biggest company that ever ran Malaysia Airlines was 19,000 people. So suddenly the whole civil service is 1.2 million people. And so suddenly the issue around scaling up everything you do mm-hmm. is very big. How do you leverage it? So this idea of making sure that the leverage game, how do you catalyze 1.3 million people to do the things in the program? Mm-hmm. And that's actually a very, very big difference. Everything's magnified to the power of 10, mm-hmm. you know, compared to private sector.
Mm-hmm. And can I ask, you know, when you say that you have to magnify everything, you know, what are ways in which you devise
how do we
to, you know, cope
Very
with that?
Simple. We, for the first time, I never, when I was in Shell and in Malaysia Airlines, I've never had this thing called a problem-solving meeting.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I created this idea of a problem-solving meeting. So then we sit together with the officers, the government people, on Friday, every Friday, we go through all the initiatives. And I was really interested in the problems that are encountered. Mm-hmm. And we call it a problem-solving meeting because I was quite deliberate about wanting the problem to surface rather than get put under the carpet. So that's one way to do it. So getting the problems there, we diagnose the problems on a weekly basis and try and resolve that. We also created a steering committee meeting on a monthly basis that when we first started, we got the Prime Minister to chair those meetings.
Mm-hmm.
And so all the problems that we could not resolve on a weekly basis, they get brought to the steering committee meeting and all the lead ministers are there with the Prime Minister. And so the decisions are made solving problems there and then during the meeting.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when we brought in the civil servants to come to that meeting, they realized how important this is and how urgent it is because the Prime Minister was chairing it. And some of them might have thought, well, this is important, but maybe not so important. But when they came to the steering committee meeting, then they realized this is so. The steering committee meeting, chaired by the top leadership, regular assessment, and we have a way of tracking this, and we have a weekly report about what are the delivery, what's not coming through. So the weekly report I get every week, and so we looked at this. If the progress is not being made, then we inquire what the problems were. And so these are new things that we put inside there to cause this to happen. And the results are actually fantastic. In 1 year of implementation, I'm astounded by the results that has mm-hmm. been achieved on most counts. And so we can talk about the results. I don't know if my colleagues had mentioned
it
to you.
Yes, definitely. I've gotten quite a bit of data on that. And I wanted to ask, you know, in terms of the service delivery chain that, you know, Pamandu has developed to link ministers and their KPIs to service on the ground, you know, via delivery management offices, mm-hmm. KPI officers, what do you think are the pros and cons of this system?
Well, the pros and cons is, the pros is that there's focus,
mm-hmm.
there's transparency, and there's accountability. That people, you know who's accountable, what's the measurement, those are very quantifiable. The cons of what we do is people can game it. That means they come with very, very low targets. And so if you were to put a target, you know, can quantify it, but target is so low that you can outdo it. No. The only way you can check whether you are putting tall targets is you make some comparisons against the past, our performance in the past. For example, crime is a good example. Crime has been rising for 4 years. If we can bring it down, street crime by 20%, that must be tall.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one. So historical comparison is one. Another one is benchmark against other countries.
Mm-hmm.
That's the other. So rural basic infrastructure, we were trying to, our program for road, for example, is not 100% compared to last year. It's 1,100% more.
Mm-hmm.
So when you put an increase in the activity level, not at 100%, but at 1,100%, surely that must be a very tall target.
Mm-hmm.
And usually the conversation when you meet people, when you put those targets, they work really hard to reduce the target. Mm-hmm. Then you know you are there. So I do believe that once you identify the cons as being people want to game the targets and want to reduce the target, you must keep on telling them it's very important to put stretch target.
Yes.
And so that, I think, is the single largest part of what we then do. Now, I think another cons is that because when you work on very specific measures of this nature and it runs through the whole country, how do you know that the data that is given out there is accurate?
Yeah.
And that's also another thing that needs to be done. So what we then do is that's why we employed external consultants or auditors.
Mm-hmm.
Under what's called agreed upon procedures so that the external auditors come out to an audit that work.
I see.
And so the other thing that we did was to bring an international panel to review our work. Sir Michael Barber is on our list, you know, and we had a few others from Australia, South Korea, and IMF, etc. They're on the list to help us. Give us what I call an outside-in view. Because we have a view that is inside out. And I really want an outside-in view, fresh view. And they usually tell us, this is how other countries do it. And perhaps we might look at this for improving our performance. And that we really need. And they give us a lot of pointers on how to make our performance better than the subsequent year. So I think the pros and cons. All said and done, there are a lot of pros to doing this, you know. And so all said and done, I would, any time, any day, I would do it like this and not recoil and do the, you know, the old way of doing it.
Yes. And, you know, can I ask, in recent months, there seems to have been, you know, a huge increase in terms of the expansion of Pamandu's mandate. And, you know, there's sort of a very strong attention placed on the ETP program. No, and Pamandu has been enlarged rapidly in a very short time. And I was wondering, what implications do you feel that this has for continued implementation of and momentum in the GTP program and the MKPI initiatives?
When we first came, there was just two of us who started it, you know, so me and Mike. And then rapidly, John, Joe, and a few others, then we became. Now, when we came, our remit was just to do government transformation, full stop. Then we got the Prime Minister and the Cabinet say, Idris, we would like you guys in Pamandu to help us do the architecture for the economic transformation. We started that work on the NKEAs, and now we're doing the competitive element called Strategic Reform Initiative. So what we have done is actually try and not increase the manpower by three times, because activity is actually three levels. We've now just done the GTP, we've done the NKA, now we're doing the SRI. So we've said, well, we don't increase our manpower by three times, the cost, but we increase it by just 1.5 times, just at an additional more, maybe a little bit more. What it means for us, we have to change our game, do much more of the leverage, use more of the private sector to be involved in. The good news for the NKA is it's private sector led. So we're really getting the private sector, their skin in the game, and they get participate. So we come there as a catalyst to cause things to happen, but really we'd like the private sector to take the lead in moving it so that we don't have too many people from outside to do this. So having a small team lean to go and deliver this is the answer. And the reason why I do not want to have a huge team is because we still need essentially the guys in all the ministries, they've got to do it.
Yes.
We are here as a catalyst to make them do it in a certain way. Big results fast. And that is the focus, and relentlessly the focus. Not to take away the role from them. They've got to do it. So the credit must be with them. They must take the credit. And our job is to help them to deliver the result, that's the ministry and the agencies within within the government. And our job is out here to work in the background, to assist them, to make sure that this is there, and to cause things to happen faster than we've done before. And I do really like to pay tribute to the police. They've done marvelous job in last year to reduce both our overall crime incidents as well as the street crime. And they've done a marvelous job, and it's absolutely superb. And they have all the credit, and we're just pleased to be part of this game to help them, enable them to do that.
And, you know, can I ask, you know, if you could summarize the sort of management techniques or management catchphrases that you feel are most pertinent, that you use you know, every day at Pamandu, what would they be?
Six. Number one, the game of the impossible. That means set targets that you yourself feel you cannot do it. Really, really stretch target. But of course, to do that, you will continuously have to battle the fear of failure, first point. Number two, anchor everything you do on the relevant key performance indicator. In this particular case, for the example that, you know, in the book, we've defined it. So everything that is we are pursuing must contribute towards achieving those KPI. So that's called, the second discipline is called anchoring on the chosen KPI. Third, discipline of action. That means there must be discipline. If you say you're going to do it next month on the 16th of next month is the deadline, it's 16th of next month. Really need to do that. So this is discipline. We call it discipline of action. That means there needs to be discipline. It needs to be action oriented. It can't be, I'm thinking about it. I'm just continuing to talk about it. We can't keep on talking. People must act. So that's the third one. The fourth one is very, very important. It's all situational leadership. Mm-hmm. That, you know, Blanchard models, you know, he states that when you start a journey on transformation at the beginning, leadership style must be quite directive. And so you will get input from people, but as a leader or the group of leaders, you must be quite directive in the approach. And so as people begin to know how to do it, they become more competent, they know how to do it, they resolve the problems. We got to change our style, must start to empower. The techniques about situational leadership is key. The problem with many leaders are they have only one repertoire. If they're directive, they're directive the whole way through. And if they're empowering, they're empowering the whole way through. What I always tell our people are, we must learn to change the leadership style depending on the team development. As the team begins the journey, we are directing. As they begin to know how to do it, you start empowering them. Mm-hmm. And that's the fourth. And the fifth principle is winning coalition. Everything you do, you must win coalition with the public through town halls. The lab is to cause everyone to agree, this is not the Pamandu idea, this is everybody's idea. Mm-hmm. You notice in the GTP, everyone who was involved in the lab, we put their names, every single one of their names in the book. Mm-hmm. Because we want to give credit to them for every single one that came out to do. We did the same to ETP, by the way. Eh? Mm-hmm. 500 people in the lab, their names are all there. And this is about winning coalition, getting everyone, they feel proud that they were part of this nation building. And so engaging the media and all these, the backbenchers, politicians, and that's winning coalition. Mm-hmm. And the sixth principle is divine intervention. Mm-hmm. And you know, I always believe in life, human beings, we control very limited parts of what happened to us. Perhaps more than 60% of what happened to us is outside our control. You know, even things like tsunami, you know, those things happen. Mm-hmm. You know, you could ask, who controls the world then? Some people say it's God, some people say it's fate, some people say it's feng shui, and some people call it luck. Mm-hmm. But really, I mean, there's a lot of things that are outside our control. So you could do all the principles that I described, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and still fail, because you're destined to fail. And you know, the beauty of understanding this is the following. We become humble because humility is part of leadership, because we need to feel vulnerable. Vulnerability, to my mind, is a virtue. And if you feel vulnerable about it, then you know that the world is not at your feet. Then you will realize that as a leader, I will do my best. My troops, they've done their best. At the end of the day, we've done our best. We can put hands on the heart. You know, I go home, I've done a decent piece of work today. If it doesn't turn out, don't shoot the troops. Mm-hmm. You don't blame people for things that happen because it just happened like that. And so this, I think, is an important thing. And I do believe that if you are religious, a spiritual individual, you should better pray very hard. And if you believe in feng shui, better go and see the feng shui master. And so I do believe that if you do this kind of thing, you know, you become a good human being. And I always tell people, let's not be corrupt, and let us make sure we do the right things. Operate the business, do your job on basic principles, on what is right, and be righteous in what we do. And if we do those types of stuff, somehow or other, God will reward you for it. The feng shui will be on your favor, and luck is on your side too, more often than not. But there's no guarantee, because things happen the way they do. The reason why this last is important is because it's counterbalance the first principle of the game or the impossible. It counterbalances it because, you know, suddenly you're not in control of everything in life. So these are the whole principles behind the mindset of people who do this kind of work. Yes, we have techniques, and I will not spend the whole time how do we do the technique 1, 2, 3, and 4. The technique can be taught. But if you don't have this mindset of that I just described, I call it the principle and the secrets of transformation, then you do not get big results fast. The whole underlying philosophy behind the big results fast hinges on the six principles.
Can I ask you, reflecting on your journey so far at Pamandu, What do you feel, looking back, that you would have done differently?
I think the thing that we would have done rather differently, if we want to start looking at it today, is that perhaps we would have brought in some external input inside the lab, right up front. I mean, some other countries, if we were able to do that. Maybe it's not easy to get, you know, people from the UK and Australia and inside the labs. Mm-hmm. That would have greatly enriched the solutioning that we were putting out there. Mm-hmm. But, you know, to invite people to come inside the labs for 6 solid weeks is kind of difficult. If we were to do it, maybe I'd want to do that one more time and bring some Americans inside the labs and other people. And because, you know, people from outside, they got different views. And some of this may be very, very instructive in making sure we have much richer and better output.
And if you were to measure, you know, how do you perceive the successes of the ministerial KPI initiative?
Yeah.
Not of Pamandu and the MKRAs, but the ministerial KPI initiative, which is sort of a different playing field.
I think the success is, of course, that they deliver the results as we measure them, and they were very specific measurements. And an example being one ministry they were supposed to do to complete 48 flood mitigation projects. And those projects were specific to that particular town or that village. And when we counted the number of people that if we did implement those projects, for here, about 2 million people will not be flooded during the Landa season. But then they implemented 42. So 1.5 million people were not flooded. And so that's the measure. So the way in which we measure, either you count 42 divided by 48 multiply 100%, or 1.5 million people divided by 2 million, that it put in percentage. That's how we do the measurement. So to my mind, really figuring out what the measurement is the key. And when we looked at it, verifying it with external auditors, then I know that they have delivered or not delivered. Mm-hmm. It's as simple as that. But the key here is the architecture behind what constitutes success. Mm-hmm. And then measuring it to the point that you feel confident that the data that's granted is put out there is you can rely on the data up to a point.
And my final question, because I know you're pressed for time, but you know, if you had the ability to write a book, for example, on, you know, units within the Prime Minister's office that try to link ministers to service delivery directly. What are the main lessons that you'd include?
I can tell you, I'll talk about the 6 things.
Okay.
Exactly those things. I will have a chapter for every single one of them. After I've now done that, I will also write the story around the application of the 6 principles in the activities and that drop them down to results. So you can talk about the principles, but the application to drive the results. And there are loads of stories in the things that we were doing. But the book will be 6 chapters. And each of them will do that. And then the whole application behind that in the work and how it's been delivered and how the results came through. Inside that book, there are loads of war stories about the good, the bad, and the ugly. And I think, you know, people will look, they want to see where we have succeeded, the areas that we kind of didn't do well in them too, and I'd like that to be part of the story.
Well, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.